So I'm going to start with the four jhanas. I'm going to read them through because I'm sure I did those before. And then when we get to the end of this paragraph on right stillness, then we get to some more interesting stuff. So I'm going to start with MN27, the four jhanas. Okay, and this will is good because it's been a month or more since I did this class because I was over in Sydney and Hong Kong. So anyway, let's start with the four jhanas. So this is from Majjhima 27. Having abandoned the five hindrances, totally free from the five senses, free from unwholesome states, you enter upon and abide in the first jhana, wherein the mind moves onto the object and holds onto it, the object being joy and pleasure caused by being totally free from the five senses. Nimitta has gone by now. In the first jhana, five things are absent and five factors are present. When one has entered the first jhana, the five hindrances are totally absent, and what is present, the mind moving onto the object, holding onto it, and the object being joy and pleasure, and there is oneness of mind. The joy and pleasure is not physical, it is a mental pitisukha. Second jhana, when the mind no longer moves onto the object because it lets go of holding onto it, you enter upon and abide in the second jhana, which has trust in the object, the bliss, enough to let go of holding it. It's going to stay so you can let it go. And unity of mind without any movement or holding, with joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. With the fading away of joy, you abide mindful and fully aware. Always have to mention these, mindful and fully aware. These aren't trances where you don't know what the heck's going on. You're fully aware. Experience of bliss purified from joy. You enter upon and abide in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones, these are ones, people who either at least a stream winner or deeper on the path, one has a pleasant abiding indeed who has such mindfulness and equanimity, especially the mindfulness. Again, emphasizing these are not cases of the mindfulness disappearing, but the mindfulness getting purified and stronger. And four, having abandoned pleasure and pain, that's all the Vedana from the five senses, and with the disappearance of joy and unhappiness, that's all Vedana from the sixth sense except for the equanimity, you enter upon and abide in a fourth jhana, which is only neutral mental Vedana remaining, just pure mindfulness with equanimity. And as you know, that if you remember the last time, the equanimity is not a dull state, but it's a very pleasurable state. If it's hard to say, the Buddha called it upeka sukha. And what kind of meditation did the Buddha recommend? Totally free from the five senses. Should we go to Gomoggallana Sutta? What kind of meditation did the Buddha recommend? Totally free from the five senses, you abide in the first jhana. When the mind stops moving onto the joy and pleasure and stops holding it, you abide in the second jhana. With the fading away of joy, you abide in the third jhana. With the abandoning of all mental pleasant and unpleasant Vedana, you abide in the fourth jhana. The Buddha only praised these four kinds of meditation. Those were the words of Ananda when asked by this Gopika Moggallana, after the Buddha passed away, asked Ananda, what type of meditation did the Buddha recommend? There are chunda, this is the Buddha's advice to his disciple Chunda, these four kinds of life devoted to pleasure that are entirely conducive to repulsion, to fading away, cessation, peace, realization, and enlightenment to nirvana. I will just pause here because repulsion, sometimes people find that that's a bit too negative, isn't it? It's more like a person who realizes they're in a prison and there's a big door through which they can escape and there's no possibility of getting caught again. You get repulsed from being in jail when there's freedom available for you. So it's pushing you away. is the word is nibbida. And sometimes looking for a good translation so people can understand this, if we look at samsara as the wheel of birth and death, and almost like a Ferris wheel, like the London Eye or something, and then nibbida is the ejection button, which pushes you off the wheel of life and death. Otherwise, you may let go, but you still keep on the wheel, round and round again, it pushes you off. Four kinds of light devoted to pleasure, entirely conducive to repulsion, to things fading away, cessation, peace, realization, enlightenment, to nibbana. What are they? The four jhanas. So if devotees of other sects should say that the Buddhists are addicted to these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told yes, for they would be speaking correctly of you. Then some people might further ask you, what benefits can you expect from a life attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking? You should reply that they can expect only four fruits, four benefits: stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. These are the benefits that you can expect from being attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking. These pleasure seeking take you away from the world of the five senses. It is true that if you do have an attachment to the jhanas, then that will keep you being a non-returner rather than a full enlightenment. But I think many of you should be satisfied if that's as far as you get in this life, just being a non-returner. That's a pretty satisfactory outcome. I may get into trouble for saying that because the Buddha will probably blame me, but at least, you know, you're close. Now, this is, you know, in Satipatthana they always talk about the one path. It's a bad translation what they say there. But this is actually from the Mahamalukyaputta Sutta. And I like this quote because there is one path only, Ananda, one way to the abandoning of the five basic fetters. These are the ones which stop you being a non-returner. There's more to do afterwards, but these five basic fetters. And the Buddha says, and it's an accurate translation, it is impossible that anyone can understand or abandon these five basic fetters without relying on that path. And I believe that last time I read this out, maybe a month ago, it's impossible you can even understand these fetters without doing this path, let alone abandon them. No more than it is possible to cut out the hardwood from a tree without cutting through its bark and sapwood. What is that path? The four jhanas and the three immaterial attainments, the arupa jhanas. Also, while you still do not experience jhana, if you haven't experienced jhana, then the five hindrances together with discontent and weariness invade your mind and remain. When you do experience jhana, the five hindrances, discontent and weariness, do not invade your mind and remain. They're gone for long periods of time, depending on how deep the jhana was, which means you feel peaceful, happy, walking on air, not literally, but just feeling nothing can sort of bother you. You find you don't need to sleep, or sleep is just very light, because the weariness, discontent are not there. And that is the time your mind is clear. And what happens next? When you have no jhana, for one deficient in jhana, the cause for seeing things as they truly are is destroyed. You can't get wisdom, not the deep wisdom. When you do not see things as they truly are, for one deficient in such wisdom, the cause for repulsion and fading away is destroyed. When you're not repulsed nor inclined to disappearing, for one deficient in these, the cause for knowledge and vision and liberation is destroyed. So the Buddha continues, develop jhana. When you experience jhana, you can understand things as they really are. And what do you understand as it really is? The origin and passing away of form, the origin and passing away of experience, Vedana, the origin and passing away of perception, the origin and passing away of will, the origin and passing away of consciousnesses. Now, I hope you were paying attention there. You can see that's plural, which is far more accurate to how the Buddha defined consciousness. Not just consciousness all the same, always being there, but the different types of consciousness, even mind consciousness, coming and going. And summing up, there is no jhana for one without wisdom. There is no wisdom for one without jhana. For one who has both jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbana. It's one of my favorite sayings. So that was the jhana episode. And I think now, if there are any questions on that, please, you can say them. And then afterwards, we'll go on to nibbana. Questions? Go on.
Arjun, why is jhana one of the few terms that's not translated? And secondly, would it be fair to say basically jhana is a deeper and deeper state of letting go and stillness?
Yeah, this is the cause for the jhanas, letting go. And how it feels, it more and more still. When things become still, things disappear. So these are stages of disappearance. And one of the reasons why it's hard to find a translation for these in English is because I've never yet seen a translation which is as good as keeping the original Pali term of jhana. No one has ever really found an English term to translate for the Buddha. And some of these terms are just so refined. I know sometimes people call it absorption. I think, what was Ajahn Sujata's word for it? Immersion. But that's immersion in what? It's not actually getting involved in something which is pre-existing. It's what's here is actually vanishing. And so it's almost like stages of vanishing. But then that doesn't really do justice to it. There are a few words, you know, which grow on us in the English language. We add them, you know, from other cultures. I think it's like Ramadan, for example. I haven't got a clue what that word means, but I know that it's one of the festivals in Islam. So why can't we have Buddhist words which really don't have a good translation in English and cause confusion if we try and find an English translation? Let's use these really pure words for what they are. See what their definition is. And then that means that people don't get so confused. I kind of like that idea, Dhamma. Can you give me a translation of Dhamma? Suggestions, and there's suggestions of that, but nothing which really holds, you know, just that whole term perfectly. Okay, this will be the last question, and I'm going to go on to further, because otherwise
Ajahn Brahm,
I end up where I ended up last time.
Ajahn Brahm, you mentioned about disappear and vanish, right? From a normal explanation of vanish is like, is no longer existence, cannot be seen with our normal eye, you know. So in this context, when we say disappear, vanish, we are talking about the eye cannot see, or we are talking about other thing?
We're talking about sight, vanish. It will come back again later. But right at that moment, it does not exist. Other things vanishing. It doesn't mean we're not paying attention to it. It's not available to us. It's just not there. Your body is vanished. It's not there. This whole idea of existence or non-existence, it's not as if this existence is permanent, always there, but not just paying attention to it. It's not the case that I'm going to be going back to Bodhinyana this evening. We've got a big ceremony, the full moon night, Patimokkha. It's not that when I leave Nolamara, sort of it's still there. That's our idea. But this is more like when you leave these states, they're just not there anymore. To actually to be, you have to... I'm getting to science again, into quantum theory. Existence is predicated on to have a person, a being who is experiencing that existence. The observer. Anyway, great. Now I'm going to go down to what happens afterwards. Okay. Summing up of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is that middle way awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Enter then upon this path and you make an end of suffering. Nirvana. When you know and see thus, the mind is no longer pulled out into the world of the five senses. It is liberated from the wanting, they call it asava. And the best translation of asava is like an outflowing. Why is it that sometimes you're happy, peaceful, just meditating, and your mind gets pulled out to things? You don't really need to, but, you know, it's just duty or people ask you. And so that flowing outwards is stopped. It no longer flows out just to be. The attachment to existing, to being, that is also extremely strong. Last night, the people driving me to this house, Dana, when they were driving me back, we just started talking about even some of the Thai monks, senior Thai monks, had the view that, you know, there is such a thing called an original mind, that an enlightened being, even a Buddha, doesn't just vanish. There's something there which still remains, which is totally against the Buddha's teachings. But then they asked, well, why are these senior monks still saying such things? And the answer is, it's this bhava-dhanha, or the bhavasava, the outflowing of being. Human beings, you want to exist. You want to be. It's very hard to let that one go. And if that is not seen through, many people would say, well, we work so hard, done so many jhanas, so much understanding and wisdom, and we call this the ultimate retirement home for the old monks. A state after death, we kind of are, but you're no longer affected by any suffering. But you are. If you are, you have to suffer. It's a bhavasava, liberated from the wanting asava, liberated from the outflowing just to be. What's wrong with disappearing, with vanishing? Do you really want to be? And I think I mentioned that in Friday's talk, if anyone was paying attention, where I went to college with some very smart people. And they were quoting in the philosophy department, they wrote this graffiti, to be is to do. Descartes, René Descartes. To do is to be, turning it around, was Jean-Paul Sartre. And that was all summed up by the modern day American philosopher, dooby-dooby-doo, Frank Sinatra. I thought that was funny. You were all here on Friday night? Okay. Anyway, and lastly, the delusion asava, the outflowing because of not seeing things truly. Do you want to see things truly? A lot of times the wisdom is available, but we don't want it. We have to let go so much. What it costs us is our existence. So that's why this is not ignorance. Ignorance, people can overcome ignorance, the avidya, by looking at the books and becoming professors. This is not like that type of understanding, it's experiential, which means one is no longer deluded. Now, it no longer leaks out because of delusion. I like the word leaks out. I changed the, I think it's legitimate, liberated from wanting, it no longer flows out just to be, it no longer leaks out because of delusion. It is liberated from the delusion asava. When liberation occurs, this is also important. When liberation occurs, the knowledge of liberation invariably follows. You can't be fully enlightened and not know it. You can be not fully enlightened and think you are, but once you are, you know it, baby, you know it. I just said that word just to impress you. The knowledge of liberation invariably follows. You understand. Birth is destroyed. What does that mean? You've already been born. No future birth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more rebirth or reappearance in any state of existence. Your deliverance is unshakable. This is your last life. Now there will be no renewal of existence. For this is the supreme noble wisdom, namely, the knowledge of the destruction of all suffering. But what if, after you become fully enlightened, you decide, well, there's so many other beings in this world who are suffering, maybe I will get reborn, I'll decide to get reborn anyway to help other beings. Is that possible? Are you enlightened? Do you know that? It's not possible simply because that idea of will, of choice, is not there anymore. And if you ever think like that, you know, other people will tell you, you haven't really understood that this is a causal process. It's not what you decide. You haven't really seen fully the nature of this thing which we call will. And a lot of times that people, of course I don't mind this, people ask the questions and argue. And there's this one lady, I think I don't mind mentioning her, you know, she was one of the Singaporean disciples who did really a lot for Dhammasara Monastery and even our monastery in here, the Angie Monksfield, Jim Leng Chu. For years I was giving her these teachings about the absence of will in deep states of meditation, telling you that this thing we call the will, we understand as the will, is not from us. We are not the one who makes these choices. It's a process. Not, you know, what they call free will. And a lot of times she would argue with me. And I like that, you know, simply because they can always test me out. But then recently that she read some sort of psychology book and it convinced her that this is modern science, that there is no such thing as free will. And she said, I just read this. Ajahn Brahm, you're right. And that's very rare that she would actually say that to me. So that made an impression. I said, no, I'm not right. The Buddha is. So, the knowledge of destruction of all suffering. And also, what would have happened? What would you think would happen if the Buddha decided to get reborn? If he ever did have that power? It was almost like a cop-out. Almost like saying, look, the birth is suffering, but I will not sort of go into parinibbana. I will come back again. It's almost like not keeping to what he tells other people to do. And that's an important part, you know, especially for monks, who actually teach by example, not just by words. You know, what you tell others to do, you have to do yourself. And so this was the case the Buddha was saying. The whole path is learning how to disappear and vanish. Not just temporarily, but completely. And that's what the Buddha did. He lived by what he taught others. The true goal. Oops, sorry. So this holy life does not have gain, honor, and fame for its main purpose, or the attainment of virtue for its main purpose, or the attainment of jhana as its main purpose, nor insight for its main purpose. The main purpose of this holy life is the unshakable deliverance of mind, full enlightenment. This is the goal of the holy life, its essence and its culmination. I know this is the word for the goal of the holy life. It's called like Dhammasara. That is why Ajahn Wayama, who gave that name to the Anand's monastery. This is what the purpose of the Dhamma is. It's not to have gain, honor, and fame. So if any of you see any of the monks or nuns sort of thinking how good they are and how great they are, and getting involved in gain, honor, and fame, please tell them off. That's not what the purpose of being a monk or a nun is. Or the attainment of virtue. Virtue is beautiful, and it's inspiring. Jhana is even more delightful. Insight, seeing things, that sometimes when you see things you haven't seen before, wow! Why am I so stupid? I can see that. Why didn't I see that before? Those are not the purposes. Those are the landmarks on the path. The main purpose is unshakable deliverance of mind, full enlightenment. That is the goal, the purpose of you being members of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. It's not so you can get access to Jhana Grove retreats. It's not to make merit. Merit is good, helpful. What this is for is so you too can experience full enlightenment. Are you ready for full enlightenment? You won't get born again. A lot of people say, maybe another couple of lifetimes. The idea that bhava dhanha, the craving to be, to exist, is a very, very difficult one to let go of. Much more difficult than sensory pleasures. So it may be that you will think the teacher's instruction has ceased when they passed away. Now we have no teacher. It should not be seen like this, for what I have taught and explained to you as Dhamma and discipline, Dhamma and Vinaya, will at my passing be your teacher. And that was such a powerful statement the Buddha made. Because people were asking him, he was about to pass away. You know, he said he was, and people believed him. So, when you pass away, who are you going to appoint to take over the leadership of Buddhism? Sariputta, Moggallana, Ananda, who will take over? And Buddha said, let the Dhamma and Vinaya at my passing be your teacher, not a person. And I don't think you understand, maybe, or maybe some of you do, how powerful that was, that statement. Never appointed a successor, the next pope or ayatollah or the next leader. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, sometimes in the West people ask the Dalai Lama, can you not do something more for women in Tibetan Buddhism? And he said, well, I'm not a leader. He's the most well-known sort of person in Tibetan Buddhism, but he did not have the authority to say, okay, you do this, you do that, you do something else. The leader is the Dhamma Vinaya. And that's one of the reasons why, when I did support and make happen the ordination of bhikkhunis here in Perth, I could do that because I never did it, the Dhamma Vinaya did it. It was according to the Dhamma and the discipline. Not according to somebody making their own rules or ordering it. It was possible. Therefore it happened. It's a powerful statement. It means that Buddhism has no leader, never will. It's the principle of Dhamma and Vinaya. That is our biggest guide. You should live as islands unto yourselves. What does that do about like community? Community is okay for the beginning, but your solitude, you are islands for yourselves. Whether you have family, whether you have a wife, husband, or three wives. No, the islands to yourself. You go to bed alone when you close your eyes. You wake up alone. You spend so much time in this life alone. And if you really get into this practice, you're never lonely. The difference between loneliness and solitude. Loneliness, you still want something or somebody. In solitude, there's no one there around you, but you don't want anything. Solitude is not always loneliness. You should live as islands unto yourselves, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dhamma as your island, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. For this reason, those matters that I have discovered and proclaimed should be thoroughly learnt by you, practiced, developed and cultivated, so that this holy life, Buddhism here, may endure for a long time, that it may be for the benefit and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of even heavenly beings, devas and humans. You know, sometimes in some of those talks you talk about heavenly beings, devas. Why would they even be interested in a place like this? Why would they be interested in a place like Bodh Gaya or any other place? For their happiness and well-being. I kind of like the idea of like heavenly beings. The higher the heavenly beings are, the longer they live. And time is very different for them. So sometimes some of the heavenly beings, say in India, in some of those holy sites, okay, it's 2500 years since the Buddha passed away, more than that. But that's just like a couple of months for some of those heavenly beings. It's not that long ago. couple of months. Do you remember the New Year's celebration we did here on January the 1st? Still, you can remember that. That's like a heavenly being, remember. This monk who sat under a Bodhi tree and became fully enlightened just a couple of months ago. Still fresh in their minds, of course, they will venerate that place. Ours was just a new year. This was somebody getting enlightened. So which do you think are greater? Said the Buddha. The few leaves that I hold in my hand, or all the leaves in the forest? Asked the Buddha. The leaves in the forest, came the obvious answer. Likewise, the things that I know but have not taught you are many like the leaves in the forest. So that means the Buddha had some teachings he never let us know. We're going to be revealed at some later time. Are there some secret teachings? Let's go and see what he says next. Likewise, the things that I know but have not taught you are many like the leaves in the forest. Whereas the things that I have taught you are few, like the leaves in my hand. The reason that I have not taught you these things is because they are irrelevant to the holy life and do not lead to enlightenment. So all the people who said there are secret teachings, and only now are people wise enough to understand them. That goes totally against what the Buddha says here. The reason the Buddha did not personally teach other things is because they have nothing to do with enlightenment. There we go. Questions? Yes. Okay. And then I know where I am the next time I sit here, the gradual training, which is a beautiful way of expressing the same path, the Eightfold Path, by the Buddha. And this is how a lot of times you can understand the other factors of the Eightfold Path by comparing them with the other expression of the path to Nibbana, the gradual training. So here we go, the first question. If one gets that Nibbida after jhana is... Okay, question about jhana. If one gets that Nibbida after jhana, is that what makes one stream winner enterer, as a mind won't crave for existence? No. Many people just crave for being a soul one or a stream winner. You can understand why. It's always asking, what is the stream winning? To be brief, the stream winning is actually seeing that that which you took to be a self is not a self. That which you... It's usually the two. Who do you take yourself to be? Who are you? And straight away somebody asked me, and you're Ajahn Brahm. No, I'm not. That's just my name. But you know, that I can recognize you. You're fat. I am not fat. I do not exist. Just associating my form with a sense of self, that's why I don't worry about fatness. I don't own it. And that's not just an excuse, that's something much deeper. You're not your body, you're not your experience, your feelings, you're not your perceptions. Perceptions change. Why do I perceive things one way? And other people perceive things another way. Why do I perceive like sausages to be delicious? And other people will say, no, they're not delicious, that's disgusting. Why? Which is truth, which is not truth? It's just perception. And you can see the perception is conditioned. That's all. And will. This is the fourth of the khandhas. I know it's will and things caused by the will, you know, sankharas. Sankharas is usually explained as volitional formations. That's a fancy word. Volition. What's volition? It's will. Will. That which you thought made you come here. Did you decide to come here? Or were you brainwashed? Both. It looks like you decided. When you look deeper, you're just totally brainwashed, conditioned, had no choice. It's nice to see it that way. When you get into meditation, you see that so clearly. How can you get into jhana? You can't do it. Your will has to disappear. You can't use the will to get rid of the will. You just let go. A lot of people don't trust that. You just let go, you're not doing anything, being perfectly at ease, and then the jhanas happen. That's why they're so difficult for many people. The stronger your will, the harder it is to let go. And so when one sees through, I call it the two citadels of the self, the will and the consciousness. Are you the one who knows? If you are, why do you know all this stuff which causes you suffering? Can't you use your knowing a little bit better? And know the good stuff and not the bad stuff. How much of your consciousness is conditioned? It's not you. Oh, yeah, exactly. So after a while, when you see through those two citadels of self, you are not the one who knows. Knowing comes and goes. You are not the one who does. So who could you be? No one. Your idea of self vanishes. You're an empty process. Cause and effect. And when that cause and effect finally runs out, it's not that you get destroyed or vanish. You weren't there anyway. Nothing gets destroyed. Nothing was there. An empty process comes to an end. Okay. And if you see that, that becomes a stream winning. You've seen through non-self. That's the main one. But then you have what is called like the habitual tendencies. You have these moments you can see so clearly. And you never forget those moments. But then there are still those times when you forget. The past is more powerful and overcomes those that great wisdom of being a stream winner. So it's like Venerable Ananda. He was a stream winner when he saw the Buddha passing away. And he lost it. The Dharma flew out the window for a while. There wasn't any windows then, but you know what I mean, that's just the expression. And then he was just leaning against a post, and his love and affection for his teacher, the Buddha, was stronger than the fact that he knew that he would have to die someday. He didn't let go enough. But anyway, that was like a temporary glitch. Once one is a stream winner, eventually those understandings you got, which were so powerful, really dominate the mind. And you don't perceive or think in those old ways anymore. These truths become so powerful, they seep into everything. Why does it say, when one has both jhana and wisdom, does someone getting a jhana not imply they have a lot of kindness, which is the same as a lot of wisdom? Kindness isn't enough. It's the wisdom, it's the teachings of the Buddha. How many of you had heard about the fact that the doer and the knower are not who you are? Even many of you you know, would object to that and say, that's just Ajahn Brahm, he's a stupid monk. But that is not the point. The point was that I put that in your brains. You've heard it. The seed has been sown. It's basically, once you hear that, you may just reject it, but it's too late, sorry. The seed of wisdom has been planted. And I could see that happening with how Ajahn Chah taught me. I thought I was so wise, and he was only 4 years at school, that's all. And then afterwards, many of the things he taught me, I kind of said, makes no sense at all. I rejected them. But then after a while, just as your meditation deepened, some of those teachings became more powerful. You're actually seeing it. And they helped. And it's the same as some of the teachings of the Buddha which I read. Only later on did you really understand how powerful they were. You know what it says? The cause for even being a stream winner, Yonisa Manasikara and Paratagosa, the words of another. And I thought, I don't need the words of another, I can figure things out myself. But then after a while, you see how important those teachings from other enlightened beings were. So that's why the jhana and wisdom is necessary. And wisdom is not just kindness, it's seeing deeply into things, how things truly are. It's just that wisdom doesn't have to be complicated. Remember, just one of the most powerful teachings Ajahn Chah ever gave me was, you know, and the circumstances are important. When Ajahn Chah just came for a sauna, he gave a brilliant talk beforehand. I was so inspired, the inspiration was so great, I decided not to help him at the sauna. I went to the back of the hall, sat on the concrete for a couple of hours. It's easy when you're inspired, not a beautiful meditation. Then the first thought, I should go and see if I can help my teacher. I couldn't help him, it was him who was going to help me. He saw me coming, and we're just going to pass on the path. And I'll say this again, he read my mind, and I allowed him to. I was actually proud of my mind in a sense, not sort of arrogant, but come and have a look, it was clean for us. I just had a nice meditation. And then he asked me, Brahma Wangso, why? And that's how great teachers teach you. Not an hour-long sutta classes, just this great one-liners. Why? And I said, I don't know. I was being truthful, he just laughed. But then, you know, he said to me afterwards, this is the answer, there's nothing. There's nothing. Do you understand? I said, yes. No, you don't, he said. And that's not just a joke, that was incredibly powerful to get that from an Ajahn Chah, just myself, after a deep meditation. And that was so important. There's nothing. Now, I don't care if you understand or not, but you've heard it. And later on, you have wonderful deep meditations. That will come up into your mind, and it'll do its job. Okay, I don't quite understand question three. The phrase unshakable deliverance of the mind. Can you say a bit more on that? Unshakable deliverance of mind. The deliverance of mind is always just you're free from the prison of the five senses, free from the prison of delusion. And it's unshakable, which means that you can't lose it. Once you're enlightened, you're enlightened. And those desires, those aversions are gone and gone forever. That's the unshakableness of it. It just doesn't come back. Question four, what about knowledge of liberation for a stream enterer? If one doesn't know birth is destroyed, what does one know in the previous stages of awakening? Yeah, for the stream winner, that's a more difficult question to answer. Do you really know you are a stream winner? The question is quite irrelevant anyway, because if you are a stream winner or you're close to being a stream winner, both of you still have to practice. You still have to cultivate the Eightfold Path more deeply. But then what stream winning is like, you know, after some incredible meditation, it's like an explosion. Can I say this? Okay, I've started. I think I mentioned this in the Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond book. Like just a metaphor, like an explosion in your mind. All this stuff, you know, your old ideas, just get blown apart. And again, you kind of feel, how could I have ever believed in that? How could I have not seen that before? You know, my teachers tell me this, the Buddha tells me this. How dumb can I be? But all of these things which get destroyed, it's like a bomb going off in a city. You can see just things going flying off everywhere. But you have to wait until the dust settles to find out how many of these defilements, cravings, attachments have really been destroyed. Or whether it's just the smoke has made the appearance that things are destroyed. You have to wait. And that patience after these experiences are really, really important. Sometimes months, sometimes years. To see exactly what is no longer there for you. How you no longer sort of take the will or the consciousnesses to be yours. How this idea of ego and self and trying to attain something gets destroyed. These are the sorts of things which vanish. And then after a while, you check, and they haven't arisen again. Well done. Yes?
Where is the subconscious in all of this? Do you class the two together or separate?
Like subconscious, it's a very interesting term. Once the mindfulness is incredibly strong, everything is available to be known. Nothing is hidden. Even just what many people say is subconsciousness is just these underlying tendencies. And you know, sometimes, you know, why these underlying tendencies? And Ajahn Brahm to tell jokes. I'm just saying this. And after a while you see why. It's not a subconscious, it's like a tendency. It's just, you know, a karmically created character which has grown over lifetimes. They used to say that Venerable Sariputta would jump over puddles. Why? And it was because that he still had some influence for lifetimes before when he was living as a monkey in a forest. I don't know if that was absolutely true, but what is subconscious and why you do that, you can actually locate the reasons for it. Make it conscious. Why sometimes people, you know, they go to therapists or hypnotherapy, regressionists, and they've got all these reasons why they do these things. It's not subconsciousness, it's just like kind of hidden a little. But he can be aware of it.
So, Ajahn, just wanted to ask a question on the previous slide.
Yeah.
I'll wait for a second. I think it was on page 48, I think, about the three asavas, kamasava, bhavasava. I think you seem to have very carefully selected the three different words to describe the three asavas. I think you are saying, where was it, that I think it's the previous one at the top of the page, I think. You said one was pulled out, other one was flowing out, other one was leaking out.
Yeah.
I think probably you, Ajahn, did you very deliberately selected those three words because the grossest is the kamasava Next is the Bhavasava, and then the Avijjava.
Yeah.
So it's the subtlest? Is that the...
Yeah, no, that's actually some nice... When I first translated it that way, I thought that's a really nice way of calling it. Where is it again?
It's on... I think it's about the asavas.
Yeah.
You said... One was kamasavas were being pulled out, bhavasavas being flowing, and the avijjasavas were leaking. I think those...
That's right, yeah. I remember the leaking one. That's good. Oh, 49, okay.
49?
Thank you. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's the one?
Yeah, Nibbana, yeah.
Yeah.
No longer flows out.
Pulled out, first
pulled
one.
Pulled out, yeah.
And then the flows out, bhavasava.
Yeah.
And then the last one. So it's the subtlest one.
Is there is, yes. It's just like trying to use more emotionally accurate descriptions of why these things pull your attention out and start to engage you in the world. And that's sometimes what it feels like. You get pulled out by the five senses. Either excitement or fear is very often the case. Wanting pulls you out. You know, the wanting, it just kind of deceives you into thinking once you get that article which you want, then you'll be happy. And after a while, you see through all of that. Been there, done that. So you don't get pulled out anymore. And that feels a much better way of describing it. And no longer flows out, you know, because of just wanting. No, let's see. From being. Being is a much more profound of these asavas. You know, this is because we want to be, we have to flow out somewhere in order to be. If you just be and don't go anywhere, your idea of being just vanishes. That's also one of the things with the jhanas, the ekagata, like the oneness, the unity. It's like, you know, when you're right inside of something, there's no objectivity, there's no sense of me and something outside. Everything is all collected together in one ball. It's like the being kind of vanishes. It's such a beautiful experience. You can maintain those jhanas for long periods of time. But eventually, you come out to be.
He's on the topic of who leads the Dhamma, who is the teacher after
who leads the
Lord
Sangha,
Buddha.
Yeah, or the Buddhism, yeah.
Yeah, then the Buddha said the Dhamma and the Vinaya.
Yeah.
Now, Dhamma, you can understand, it is continuing, there is enough information to continue with the right Dhamma. But the Vinaya, it's not uncommon that some sects and some individual monks within the same sect adopt a lot of flexibility for to be right. And
Not really, because the Vinaya is pretty clear.
Like handling money.
Sorry?
Handling
cash. That's pretty clear.
Yeah. It is clear, but there is a lot of...
Yeah. The same
wrong
as the
practices happening.
The Dhamma, the suttas are pretty clear. It's repeated so many times.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, people can choose which suttas they read and focus on. And that is a really kind of an amazing thing. You know, you tell them, like, ordination of bhikkhunis. Look at there. It's what the Buddha wanted. You can quote this and quote that and quote something else. It's consistently approved. But still people say, oh no, you can't do that. No, it's illegal. The reason why they say that is because they don't want it to happen. The reason why they distort these suttas is because they don't want to be shown that they haven't got enlightened yet.
Pardon, Brahms, I have a clarification. So the way I see the Four Noble Truths leading to the Eightfold Path is to have Sila, Dana, Panya. It's Panya being wisdom.
Sila, Samadhi, Panya usually.
Oh, Samadhi, is that the middle one?
Yeah.
Not Dana?
Yeah.
Okay. So my question then is, that's the two that I'm thinking about, Panya and Samadhi. So I've read somewhere that sometimes Panya, the wisdom, can come up and then the concentration catches up. And at other times, concentration can go, be the forerunner, and then wisdom will catch up. They're like go hand in hand. And I think one of the suttas Buddha does talk about that they go as a pair.
No, that's samatha vipassana. But the saying of the Buddha is that that samadhi pachaya yata bhutayana dasana, it's from the stillness, is the cause for seeing things as they truly are. It's nothing to do with your knowledge or your cleverness of mind, your power of your brain. It's just the stillness is the cause for the arising of wisdom. Samadhi pachaya yata bhutayana dasana.
So wisdom is not book knowledge. Wisdom is to see the three characteristics of impermanence,
indeed,
dukkha and non-self, isn't it?
Seeing things as they truly are.
Yeah. So it's experiential wisdom.
Yes.
So not
just experiential, you do need the words of another also in there to be the seed.
Yeah, that's and what I'm finding when we are learning more about the teachings of the Buddha.
Yeah.
Because our mind alone can't understand some of the experiences.
Indeed.
So then you need the words too.
You need the words and also the encouragement. And then eventually the mind becomes still. And this is... it's common here that people get into deep meditations and they haven't got a clue what it is. Sometimes they can be scared and have this wonderful opportunity, you know, to see deeply into things, but they get too overpowered. Yeah?
I'm just asking this on behalf of another person. How would you explain after meditating for a while when illness disappears?
When what disappears?
Illness.
Oh. Look, when you meditate for a while and the body starts to vanish, and that so you can't feel the body anymore, that is amazing. Just the body relaxes. Places which are inflamed, they loosen that inflammation. The body has a chance for whether you call it chi or the vata, the winds, you know, in Indian Buddhism, has a chance to do something. The mind is so powerful. Some of these things, I don't know how it works, but you experience it working. I give many sort of talks about that. I haven't had cancers that I know about, but you know, sometimes you feel a bit, something's up somewhere. You go and meditate, and afterwards you feel, you know, so healthy. I mentioned so many times about food poisoning and just, you know, really having spasms in my guts because I don't know what I ate. And just meditating and just vanished in half an hour. And that was kind of impossible. And there's so many other times like that. You've had illnesses, sicknesses, and then you learn how to meditate and just relax the body so deeply, and sometimes the body vanishes itself, and then things go. It certainly happens. And I think many of these illnesses, you know, could be because one is so afraid and one responds in such a way that you don't allow the healing to happen. Anyway, that's a quick answer there. Who else wanted to answer questions, ask questions? Because I'm getting close to the end of the time now. I have to get back today on time again because it's a Patimokkha night. The whole Sangha meets.
Thank you, Ajahn. Yeah. I just have a question. I wanted to know if doing things like being in the nature, touching the grass, touching the tree, so things that are perceived with the five senses, doing sport, running, I don't know, swimming, does it stop us from being liberated?
No, it doesn't stop you from being liberated, but it's just, you know, is that a good use of your time? So if there is, say, a monk or a nun is asked by their doctor, you know, you need to do more walking, or, you know, you may have a bad back, can you do swimming? That'd be fine if there's a good reason for it. Going into nature, I remember when I was in Berkeley, someone invited me to do forest bathing. I didn't know what they were talking about. It's a walk in the forest. They called it forest bathing. But anyway, I thought, no thank you, I'd rather just sit in my room and meditate. Because that is, it's not a problem, and especially if you've got lots and lots of time to meditate, and you've got so much free time, having a walk in nature is a beautiful way of relaxing the body and preparing it to sit on the cushion. Nature is not such a dangerous thing for people who are intent on enlightenment to enjoy, because you can't control nature. There's all the trees in the forest, they may be bent and twisted, but I can't straighten them. The most beautiful sunsets, you look at the sunsets, you enjoy them, but if you want them to last for a long time, you can't capture them. You have to let these things go. Even the grass, you touch the grass, but then the grass disappears. And it's also the case that, I've said this many times, that when you have a lovely meditation, a deep meditation, the five hindrances start to vanish. You open your eyes, if you want to see a blade of grass, then touch it, you know, when the five hindrances are gone. Wow! That is so amazingly sort of interesting. You start seeing the power of the mind, just a blade of grass. Remember that lovely phrase of nature, to see a world in a grain of sand, heaven in a wildflower, infinity in the palm of your hand, eternity in an hour. That's, you know, the poem which I read from William Blake when I was at university. And that really sort of hit me, to see a world in a grain of sand. You're using your five senses, but you're seeing how powerful they can be when the mind is clear. See a heaven in a wildflower, wow. And sometimes you see people doing that. That's what I really love when you teach a retreat and people get into these deep meditations. You see them standing on the path, just looking at a little blade of grass. And you're quite welcome to look at that for the whole hour and a half or 2 hours. You never get, you're not crazy. You actually, your mind is opening up. That's why it's helpful.
Thank you.
I don't know if I answered the question.